Well, knowing 80 people were going to be in the mountains, I figured the only way I was going to have more than three people to talk to would be to have this about sex. And I'm glad to see that it worked, and I'm hoping that I can meet at least your intellectual needs and possibly prurient interest in talking about our bodies, ourselves, and our identity, which is really talking about the physical and talking about sex. We have a difficult and complex relationship with our bodies, ourselves, and with each other. You might think, and probably should think, that for this miracle of incarnation, which is that we have bodies and we are alive in them on a beautiful day and spending time with each other, that it would just be, pardon the expression, unadulterated joy to be living sexual beings who can reach out in many ways physically and emotionally, touch and be touched in so many ways. And that should be cause for every society just to celebrate the everyday miracle of being here and of how we got here. And those two things tend to be related, and they just give theologians and the religious, not necessarily the same thing, and philosophers fits. Because most of us got here through sex. And religions look at things not completely crazy, but we look at things in the material and the spiritual. There are the things, there's material existence. And it's pretty good. I mean, we have lights, we have heat, we have air conditioning, and Ron operates all of them at the same time, sometimes in contradictory ways back there. But we celebrate it all nonetheless. And we have bodies, and we have these wonderful, comfortable pews that let me go on for 2-3 hours at a time. I'm just kidding, okay? But what happens historically is that philosophers and the religious seem to turn existence into the material and the spiritual. And the material is obviously, to them, inferior because the material gets old. It breaks down. It starts to make funny noises when it sits down and stands up and goes down the stairs. And I'm only talking about myself at this point. It can't see in the dark very well anymore and needs more light to read. And from the beginning of time, philosophers have looked around and said, you know, the body's an inferior instrument. This miracle of life must continue on in another dimension, and that's the real thing. So here's the deal with these bodies you have. Don't mess up eternity for the pleasures of today. And so we get into these strange little contradictions around sex and sexuality. Every primitive tribe in the world, when it finally figured out that there was a relationship between sex and conception, was left with a conundrum. Make your own conundrum joke here. And that conundrum was, how do we encourage conception and birth, which is clearly beautiful and holy, and discourage sex, which is clearly embarrassing and we don't want to talk about it? Of course, we do want to talk about it. This is one of the first great hypocrisies, that this is the sensitive subject. You don't talk about this stuff. No, it's true, you don't. But you joke about it. You sing about it. You make dirty puns about it. You do all kinds of things about it, except really express in a straightforward manner the joys of the flesh. And when you do it in code, so that in the Bible you get Song of Songs, which is probably one of the sexiest things ever written, if you understand that every geographic location and every food and fruit that is mentioned is actually a symbol for a body part. You're all going to go home and read Song of Songs this afternoon, I can tell. Ratings for the football games among Unitarian Universalists in Fullerton are tanking, and the Bible is coming out. It is just remember that all those things are body parts. So we're dealing with these contradictions. We're dealing with contradictions and changes in society. Changes in society where our ancestors believed that conception was the most important thing. That when we look at religious laws and traditions, we really are looking at conception-efficient behavior. So that when we look at the historic antipathy towards homosexuality, our primitive ancestors kind of figured out that no matter how sincerely two men tried or two women tried, they weren't really going to increase the size of the tribe. And enthusiasm just didn't seem to play a role in whether or not they were able to conceive with each other. And once upon a time, the size of the family and the size of the tribe was equivalent to power. You wanted to grow a big tribe so that you could defend yourself or equally go and invade somebody else. You wanted to grow a large family because they were your old age insurance. The world, dear friends, has changed. I have 7 grandchildren. I know what tuition is in private high school. I can guess what tuition is going to be at the university level, and I can assure you with the apodictic certainty that most clergy pretend to, and I usually don't, but in this rare exception I will tell you, that having a lot of children and grandchildren may be wonderful, but it does not increase your wealth. It increases your liability. And it may be really good for your heart, but the bank account, not so much. And so our attitudes slowly change and slowly evolve, just the way that sex slowly evolved. You will remember that Tom Robbins pointed out that the first amoeba is still alive. But the first amoeba is not having that great a time. It's just dividing along and hasn't made a lot of progress, hasn't really evolved. And human beings, through sex and sexuality, have, and this is the scientific word for this, we have, by exchanging genetic information, isn't that a nice way of putting it? We have, through exchanging genetic information, come to the point where we are human beings. It has made evolution possible. It has also, the conservatives are right, made death possible, because if that first amoeba had died, well, that would have kind of been it for all amoebitude. It would have been the end of the game. But this exchange of genetic information has let us evolve minds, civilizations, make choices, learn, develop, and change. And it's a precious gift. And the ambivalence that we have about it, it's traditional and it's understandable. The Bible on the subject of sex and sexuality, as I hinted a couple of paragraphs ago, is ambivalent. The Bible, strangely enough, is more pro-sex than it is pro-love. Love is the great danger, because love brings down thrones, and love can make you break the rules. So that going all the way back to Rachel, and there is a thunderstruck moment of love, and all of a sudden everything is out of whack. There is, of course, David. In modern times, we understand the allure of sex and sexuality, and we don't have to go all the way back to the ancient days of Clinton. We can go back to this week in Petraeus and understand that those drives are unruly and considered dangerous, and often are in fact dangerous. And so we do understand why there is so much ambivalence about this at once precious and holy and dangerous and disturbing part of everybody's life. How our hearts, our souls, if you will, relate out to other people. How we see them, how we think about them, how we feel about them, how we love them, and the spectrum of what that love is. I will admit to you that this is not in my manuscript, but I was sitting here looking up at "we need not think alike to love alike." That's absolutely true in my view. But we also don't have to love alike to think alike. How we love each other, with what sincerity, with what depth, with what consideration, is far more to me important than what our sexuality is. We used to say in Berkeley in the 60s, and I remember it vaguely, the question that was being debated was, is biology destiny? And the position back then was, it is not. That meant, you know, are women bound to have a glass ceiling forever because they're just biologically different? There's a more nuanced question, and that is gender destiny? Because today we understand, as I think most non-gay people did not understand in the past, that there is a difference between gender and sexuality, and that we all live on a spectrum of what is attractive to us and how it is attractive to us and how we express it to each other. And it seems to me that the content of our feelings, our respect, our relationships are more important than the mechanics of it. And we get caught in our society in the issue of mechanics. And by that I mean the various positions of coupling and of so forth that are the things that we joke about but don't really want to talk about. In my lifetime, in my professional lifetime, I have seen the most amazing change in our attitude about sex and sexuality. From the attitude of the 50s to the attitude of the 60s, and drawing back from the 60s, and the expansion of the recognition of the sexuality and the tremendous spectrum of sexuality in our world. That when we started talking about gays, we meant men. Then all of a sudden, you know, women too? Oh yeah, I remember that story. Yeah, okay, cool. And we talked about women. We're still a little strange on that. Only this morning on NPR, they were talking about how how did they put this? Oh, yeah, that's right. Elected to the Senate was a lesbian woman. Now, that's possibly redundant. You know, this is kind of like I was talking to a Jewish rabbi. But the truth is, this last election was a huge mark, in my view, of progress on it not being relevant how we love each other, except to us and the people we love. That politically, three of the four initiatives that were voted on for the first time were voted on and passed to allow same-sex marriage, which I admit I have a dog in this fight. Since I perform marriage, I have some interest in this. It is a retail revenue source for me. But even before it was a retail revenue source for me, it was something that was important, that back in 1969, for the first time, I blessed a same-sex union. But today, it's not just for Unitarians or Unitarian Universalist clergy. I have Anglican friends and colleagues, Disciples of Christ friends and colleagues, Methodist friends and colleagues, Rabbi and Cantor friends and colleagues who also bless same-sex unions. This is a tremendous change. What brought it about? I'm not clear. I have a sneaking suspicion that Will and Grace certainly helped, that Modern Family certainly helps, that in the same way that the Cosby Show made a difference, it helped. Our media help in this. But it's also a question of timing. You could not have done the Cosby Show in the 1950s. And I don't think you could have done Will and Grace in 1970. There's been societal evolution, and it isn't simply chicken and egg. It has been reinforcing and seeing a greater and wider view of the human spectrum of sexuality and how we see each other, how we treat each other, how we love each other. And for me, this is tremendous progress. That we are, in fact, in some ways, seeing as more important than the mechanics the issue of love, the issue of connection, the issue of how we respect each other, how we celebrate each other and take care of each other in our various needs. We understand now more than we ever did, I think, in the past, that there's a spectrum of what we human beings need and how we need to be acknowledged, how we need to be held. And it doesn't go in those very neat, usually zero and one categories that most of us were trained to think this is how the world is. You are male or you're female. You are straight or you are perverted. No, we're all really complex. And that's wonderful. We're all really the product of evolution that's brought us to this point. We are all trying to adjust to a world where growing population is a Ponzi scheme, and that even China has rejoined the Ponzi scheme and is reexamining the one family, one child, because we're trying to figure out how to get people to work and support us and don't understand at some deep level that numbers really are not the equivalent of wealth and power anymore. And so we're still fighting battles on several fronts on this. We still have our snarky jokes, our discomfort with issues of sex and sexuality. We don't want to picture either our parents or our children doing it, and we all know what it means. We're a little more comfortable picturing strangers doing it. That always struck me as strange, but true. And listen, in Los Angeles County, we just had to vote on how to dress for pornography. And we have our city salons in Los Angeles talking about the tragedy of losing the porn industry in the San Fernando Valley. That's another conversation I never thought I would hear elected officials say, what can we do to save pornography? Go out there and buy. And the real pornographers are being put out of business, like everything else on the net, by amateurs with cameras on their telephones. But the issue of sex and sexuality, the idea that pleasure is bad, that our bodies are bad, that there is some eternal form of love that it's much better to deal with, I'm not going to draw judgments on the eternal forms of love. I'm not going to draw judgments on how love or sex or all those things can make fools of us, because life can make fools of us in all different kinds of ways. You don't have to be sexually stupid to be stupid. You can be politically stupid. You can be business stupid. You can invest in bubbles. There are lots of possibilities, but we really only normally demonize one of them. And I guess what I'm saying is what you already know. And if ever there was a preaching to the choir, this would be the preaching to the choir. And that is, we have this marvelous incarnation where we are alive in bodies that can give and receive pleasure. We are alive in bodies and with minds that can give compliments or cut people apart, where we can use our arms to build arms or to embrace other people. We have huge choices that we can make and a tremendous spectrum of diversity that most of history has found threatening and that we are beginning to find enriching. I hope we continue to grow. I trust we continue to grow. When I look at how the next generation reacts to these issues of sex, gender, and sexuality, I see tremendous reasons for hope in the future. And anything we can do that makes that future look hopeful is something that we can use to energize ourselves, to engage and to celebrate this beautiful day and this beautiful life that we share for these brief moments together. As we explore ways to be with each other, as we explore ways to love one another.